Today's sponsor is Audible. With an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more. Get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial at www.audible.com/suspect.
The streetlights come on, it's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. Not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering has tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK and Scott Reeder. I'm Lacey Scarmana. Pre-trial motions for the Stanley Liggins case will start next week. So, Scott, what are your thoughts as we approach this first formal step toward the trial? Does a verdict look clear-cut for one side or the other?
No, it doesn't. People send me emails all the time saying things seem really clear-cut in this case. But it's important to remember that a lot of the things that listeners to this podcast are finding out, the jury will never hear. For example, the fact that Stanley knew Jennifer's family because he was allegedly supplying cocaine to them, the jury will never hear that. That he was arrested for abusing another 9-year-old girl, that the jury will never hear that. That he served time for armed robbery and was acquitted of murder charges in prison, the jury will never hear that. Also, the prosecution's two main witnesses have what could be perceived as some credibility issues. For example, the woman who saw the taillights that night. Well, what never came out in the first two trials is that before she testified in the Liggins case, she had been made a paid police informant in a number of other cases. In fact, she'd gotten over 80 payments from the Davenport Police Department, and that never came out. I think it's all but certain that the defense is going to do everything they can to impeach her testimony by bringing this up and going after that. Also, you know, the cellmate who said he heard a confession from Stanley. Well, I went out into Sioux City and interviewed him. You know, he says that he was threatened with being charged with accessory to murder after the fact if he didn't testify. Now, Bill Davis, the prosecutor in the case at the time, says that's nonsense, but even that raises some questions because Bill's basically calling into question the credibility of one of his own witnesses on another matter. So it's a very difficult case to prosecute all the way around.
So what strategy do you think the defense will use?
If it's anything like the first two trials, I think it's going to be the stepfather. They're going to point towards the stepfather, Joseph Glenn, as being the culprit in this case. He said and did a lot of weird things. They're odd and just hard to figure out why somebody would act the way he's said to have acted. Here's an example. This came from when I interviewed Detective Kevin Murphy, who was one of the lead investigators in the case.
I mean, he wanted to go in and see Jennifer's body. And, you know, by rights, they have a right to do that. Sherry wanted nothing to do with it. I mean, she stood over by the door about, you know, 30, 40 feet away. And I brought the sheet down a little bit. And Joe just kind of looked at her and kind of looked at her and looked at me. He says, are you sure she wasn't hit by a car?
What?
Yeah, I'm pretty damn sure about that, Joe.
He stands there and makes smart-ass remarks like that, saying really stupid crap. I mean, I don't get it. What kind of human being would ever do that? Here's another example.
Joe would talk to me. He says, well, this is what the outfit I'm wearing to the funeral. I'm going to look really cool on top of the runner. No, you're not, Joe. I said, go borrow a suit or buy one of the Salvation Army or something.
We want to give him a chance to respond, but he can't be found.
Yeah, I mean, of course we can't predict how someone will react in a time of grief or tragedy, but those are certainly strange comments coming from Jennifer's stepfather. So with all that in mind, what do you think will happen when this case goes back to a jury?
It's hard to say, but I think it will be hard to get a guilty verdict. I've just mentioned a lot of the problems the prosecution will face, and there isn't a smoking gun. The case is based on circumstantial evidence. Witnesses have died or are missing, so their testimony will have to be read in court. That takes away a lot of the drama that you'd ordinarily have during testimony. It's going to be a very hard case to get a conviction on. I'm not saying it won't happen, but it's going to be a very hard case to get a conviction on.
So last week we learned the defense filed a motion for a change of venue. Talk about why they would want to change the location of the trial.
The reason they typically seek a change of venue is because they think the pretrial publicity has been so great that they needed to move it away from that media market. Now, the other factor in this that can play into a change of venue is this case is 26, 27 years old. It was tried originally in this community. It's one of the most high-profile cases we've ever had in the Quad City area. And a lot of folks just remember the case from way back then. They remember the details, and they remember some of the things that, you know, frankly, the defense probably doesn't want them to remember.
Bill Davis says moving a trial creates a lot of challenges for the prosecution.
There's nothing more difficult for a prosecutor than trying a change of venue case because you don't have your assets around you. You can't just make a phone call and have a certain detective come over or a police officer run down something for you.
Plus, he says the prosecution carries the burden of proof, meaning they'll have more evidence and witnesses to present to the jury. Stanley Ligon's first defense attorney, Gary McHenrick, who later became a judge in Scott County, explains the cost involved in moving a trial.
There's some incremental cost to the judicial branch just in terms of the travel expense and housing expense for the judge and court reporter that have to travel. That's really the only part that hits the judicial branch. There's obviously cost to the public defender's office in terms, same types of things for their lawyers and then for any witnesses that they would have, and obviously significantly more costs for the state, the county attorney's office, because they've got the burden to present all those witnesses and get them transported to the venue and if they need to house them overnight.
And since county prosecutors are elected, Bill Davis says switching to a different county takes away some of the inherent trust a jury might have in them.
Being an elected official in a community means something, or I like to think it did, when you're trying to pick a jury in your own community. Here's something that the community has shown enough respect for, a person, that they elected him, and that he's going to be doing his job here, he's going to be protecting this community and us. Well, I go into another jurisdiction, I don't have that.
Plus, building a jury is harder when the lawyers aren't familiar with the area.
And I don't know the jury. I don't know the town. I don't know the pool. So what you do is, first of all, you map the county. Then you sit down with a seasoned prosecutor and a couple of cops from that jurisdiction. And you go over, okay, right here, these folks are blue collar. They work probably in the packing company. These folks over here are the Heights and so on. So, you know, you can look at that primarily. And then you can tell what manufacturers and what employers are in town, what churches, and get a feel for the jury as much as you can. But all that stuff you know if you live in the community.
During jury selection, a pool of candidates comes in for voir dire. That's the preliminary questioning of potential jurors. Both the prosecution and defense get 10 strikes without cause, meaning they can remove a person from consideration for any reason. Jury selection takes strategy. We talked with a jury consultant about the type of juror he would suggest the defense look for. He is not working with Stanley's defense team. Scott Reeder first met Robert Hirshhorn several years ago.
Almost 30 years ago, I was a young
reporter in Galveston, Texas, and I covered criminal courts down there. And I met a young attorney about that time. His name was Robert Hirschhorn, and he was just starting out in his career as well. And he was an absolutely brilliant attorney. His focus was on providing defense to criminal defendants. And one of the things he was known for is his ability to pick a jury. Now, a lot of folks maybe listen to this and say, well, that sounds kind of boring. But to me, I've covered so many trials over the years, and I've always found jury selection to be one of the most fascinating parts of covering a trial. Robert is exceptionally good at finding people who will think in a certain way to get an end result.
Robert Hirschhorn has been a consultant on several high-profile cases. For example, he helped build the jury that acquitted former BP oil rig engineer Robert Kaluza. Kaluza was a rig supervisor on the Deepwater Horizon offshore rig that exploded in 2010, killing 11 workers and spilling millions of gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. He was charged with violating the Federal Clean Water Act, but a jury found him not guilty. Robert Hirschhorn also helped George Zimmerman's defense team select their all-female jury that acquitted him of second-degree murder and manslaughter charges for shooting 17-year-old Trayvon Martin.
We thought outside the box. So here's what the normal thinking was. This is what all the pundits on TV said that I was crazy for putting in an all-female jury. That the women are going to have empathy for the mother who lost her son, right? That's conventional thinking.
Prosecutors said George Zimmerman racially profiled and murdered Trayvon Martin. But the defense said George Zimmerman shot Trayvon in self-defense after being attacked.
And I thought about if it was a woman that was in George's position and she had a gun, what would she do? And I concluded that every woman, if they found themselves in George's position where a guy was on top of you and they had a gun, those women would have fired that gun. A man might have tried to, you know, fight him back. A woman would have fired a gun.
Robert says Stanley Liggins' case presents another opportunity to think outside the box.
I'm looking for Trump voters. I'm looking for patriots. I'm looking for skeptics. I'm looking for people that don't trust the government. The reason why I want a patriotic juror is because this is one of those cases with terrible facts and it's thin on evidence linking this defendant to this horrific crime.
He says ideally, Stanley's defense team could even look for another all-white jury.
You got to know, look, if I've got a likelihood of an all-white jury, I need an all-white message.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about the possible locations the trial could move to. You had a birthday this week, Scott. What did your wife end up getting you?
Well, this week she got me headphones so I can listen to Audible. I love listening to books. It makes downtime in the car and when I'm working out, when I'm doing all kinds of things, so much more productive because I can listen to a book and learn something and entertain myself. You know, today when I drove up from Springfield to work in the studio, I listened to The Night Stalker, The Life and Crime of Richard Ramirez. So if you like true crime, and I'm betting the folks who listen to this do because they're listening to suspect convictions, I highly recommend listening to Audible. And better yet, because you listen to Suspect Convictions, you get a free audiobook if you just sign up for a 30-day free trial. Just go to www.audible.com/suspect. That's it. Once again, www.audible.com/suspect, and you can get a free audiobook. You'll love it.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions. Scott Reeder explains the demographics of where the Stanley Liggins case could potentially move to.
And Iowa is one of the most ethnically homogenous states. Two of the more diverse communities in Iowa, though, or outside of the Quad City area, are Black Hawk County, where the county seat is Waterloo. That community is about 8% African American. And Polk County, where Des Moines is the county seat, and that community is 4.8% African American. These are diverse communities, as you can see, by Iowa standards. These, in other places across the U.S., these wouldn't be considered particularly diverse communities at all.
So Robert Hirshhorn says the defense would be kidding themselves if they think they'll get many or any African Americans on the jury. Gary McHenrick says diversity is what they strive for. He says the belief in the jury system is that the broader background of experience you bring to a jury, which can mean race, gender, income, or other factors, the more likely you are to get a fair collective judgment based on evidence.
You know, from the standpoint of having African Americans on the jury, it's they have different life experiences than white people do. And I mean, you've seen numerous studies that the media have undertaken and that social scientists have documented of the difference in how African Americans are treated, you know, going into a department store versus white individuals, that they're watched more, that they're followed more, that they're approached more by store employees. I mean, you've heard plenty of talk over the last couple of years with everything that's gone on about what in the African American community is called the talk that parents have with their sons. You know, that you're an African American male, and you know, if you're approached by the police, you do what the police tell you. You know, you don't assert your rights. You don't do things that could get you shot.
Former prosecutor Bill Davis agrees that a jury should be diverse. He says pure objectivity is a myth, but having a variety of people on the jury can balance that out. As for people he wouldn't want on the jury, he says he would avoid young people or newcomers to the community. He also wouldn't want people who don't like law enforcement or who have been victims of violent crimes. But one type of juror he would like to have?
I would look for Trump voters, if at all possible. People who voted for President Trump.
His reasoning behind this particular choice is a bit different than Robert Hirshhorn's. Robert wanted skeptics who don't trust the government. But Bill Davis says he's looking for people who voted for President Trump because Trump cast himself as the, quote, law and order candidate. To get the type of jurors they want, lawyers have to ask specific questions during voir dire. Bill Davis says he would look for political bumper stickers on the way into the courthouse and ask people how they feel about the current political climate. Robert Hirshhorn explains his strategy for sussing out potential racial biases.
The lawyer's got to make a decision. Do you deal with the elephant in the room, or do you just go past it? And my view is you got to deal with the elephant in the room. But understanding that you got to deal with the elephant in the room, what you cannot do is say, okay, if you're a racist, raise your hand. Nobody's going to admit to being a racist. So then what you got to do is you got to figure out a way to address that issue.
To deal with that issue, Robert says lawyers have to ask probing questions.
Questions like, if your daughter or son said, I'm bringing my fiance home to meet my parents for the first time, and their fiance was black, what would your reaction be? What kind of problems do you think they would have as a couple, you know, in terms of how they were seen or perceived by society? But then I'd really want to ask a question that says, look, Stan, you always got to give your client a nickname because it humanizes him. Stan, he's the only black person in this courtroom. Now, here's the question I got for you. I want you to imagine that you or a loved one of yours is accused of a crime, a very serious crime. And you're in a venue. That means you're in a place. You're in a court where everybody is black. Judge is black. Prosecutor's black. Your lawyer's black. All the jurors are black. And you're the only white person in the courtroom. or everybody's Hispanic and you're the only white person in the courtroom, or everybody's Chinese and you're the only white person in the courtroom, how would you be feeling? And then I'd ask, what can we do in a situation like this to make sure that Stan gets a fair trial?
If the defense's motion for a change of venue is denied during pretrial hearings, they could still ask for a bench trial before the case goes back to court. In that case, Marlita Grieve would decide the verdict based on the evidence. She's the chief judge of the 7th District of Iowa. She went to the University of Iowa College of Law in Iowa City and worked as a private practice lawyer from 1992 until her judicial appointment in 2006. Gary McHenrick, Stanley Ligon's first defense attorney, later worked alongside Marlita when he also became a judge in Scott County. He explains what sparked Marlita Grieve's interest in law school.
She had been employed in a financial institution earlier in her one of her previous lifetimes and suffered employment discrimination based upon her gender in that institution, successfully legally combated that, and that got her interested in the law and led her to law school, and then practicing in that field, you know, discriminatory action as a plaintiff's lawyer, and ultimately was appointed to the bench.
He respects her work.
I think she's highly intelligent. She's very plain spoken. I consider her to be one of the best judges in our district. She listens to the evidence, and she works hard at trying to make a decision that's right with the law and right with the facts.
Former Scott County Prosecutor Bill Davis has never tried a case in front of Marlita Grieve, but he did work with the current prosecutors, Mike and Julie Walton. In fact, Julie Walton worked as second chair with Bill on Stanley Ligon's second trial in 1995.
It's comforting for me to know how well she knows the case, but also that she and her brother Mike are so well-trained and able.
Mike Walton was appointed Scott County Attorney in 2007. He got his law degree from Hamline University of Law in 1987. And his sister, Julie Walton, is the assistant Scott County Attorney. She went to the University of Iowa College of Law. Stanley Ligon's second defense attorney, Mike Toby, remembers what it was like to argue against Julie in court.
She does have that same avenging angel mindset that a lot of these police officers have. She is what I would call a vicious advocate. That does not mean that she is unethical. It's just that she has disdain for the rights to defense.
But Bill Davis says that is not a fair characterization.
If I were to say the same things that Julie says, then I would be the bulldog, and I would be what people expect me to be. But if Julie does it, then there's something wrong. And I think the comparison I might drew before was Marcia Clark.
She was the prosecutor in the O.J. Simpson case.
Every morning, people wanted to know what a witch she was, and what did she? But then again, they wanted to know how she'd done her hair and what kind of a dress she had on. It's just, unfortunately and unfairly, a different standard.
Gary McHenrick says that after more than 20 years, some prosecutors would decide not to retry a case and instead let the defendant out on a deal, for example, releasing them on time already served. But he is not surprised Mike and Julie Walton decided to proceed with the case against Stanley Ligon's.
I think they are convinced of the justness of the position that was taken earlier, and so they're going to do their best to prosecute it again.
He says they're both passionate lawyers.
Tenacious is a good word for Julie. I think Mike is more analytical in his approach, perhaps Julie a little more emotion.
As for the defense team, Stanley's defense attorney was going to be Phil Ramirez. The trial has been postponed several times due to Phil's health problems. In September, he stepped down, and Derek Jones, who was Phil's assistant attorney in the case, now leads the defense team. He also went to law school at the University of Iowa. Kent Simmons, another University of Iowa law grad, was the man who successfully appealed Stanley's conviction and has given him his third chance for freedom. Kent represented Stanley through nearly two decades of the appeals process. But in 2014, he told the Quad City Times that he would not represent Stanley in the trial, as he would likely have to testify during it. The Times reported Kent did not elaborate on his potential testimony. Bill Davis says Kent Simmons is an excellent lawyer.
Top notch. He was, when I first got elected, he was my very first law clerk. It was a new program, and he was a senior in law school and worked for us for a year. Then did some appellate work right out of law school. Federal murder case, went to the United States Supreme Court.
That seems to be the general consensus among the lawyers we've talked to. Gary McHenrick also spoke highly of Kent's abilities.
He will know the facts better than anyone else in the courtroom. And he'll know the law as well as anyone else in the courtroom, if not better. You know, he's very selective about taking shots where he can be effective in poking holes in a case. He's not going to try to shotgun a case. He's going to pick where he wants to make the fight and do very well in that area.
Both the prosecution and defense teams have denied our requests for interviews. In the last episode, former prosecutor Bill Davis talked about why he doesn't like media coverage of trials. Gary McHenrick says the defense is also wary of the press.
To some extent, the defense is always at a disadvantage when it comes to the news media, because there's not a lot from the defense standpoint that you can put out to the media before the trial. Part of it is you don't want to give up trial strategy. Part of it is in terms of the rules of ethics and what can be said and what can't be said. So the only people talking to the press generally in criminal cases, you know, up until trial are the police and the prosecutors. So to some extent, what informs the news media coverage of a case like Stanley's, for example, it is from the prosecution's viewpoint prior to trial. And then at the beginning of trial, obviously, because they're presenting their case. My impression, representing Stanley the first time around, was the news media had that kind of bias in its reporting about halfway through the trial. And then all of a sudden, it's like a light came on and said, oh, there are problems with the state's case. There are some issues here.
After next week's pretrial motions, we'll have a better idea of the strategies for both sides. Stay tuned for updates. Next time on Suspect Convictions, we'll have a panel discussion with former prosecutor Bill Davis and Stanley Ligon's second defense attorney, Mike Toby. The conversation will be moderated by Scott Reeder and other true crime writers. Production support comes from Alfredo Monteca. Big thanks to Colin Thompson and Cast Media for our online presence. And thank you to WVIK CEO Jay Pierce and the WVIK staff. All archived audio was generously provided by WQAD-TV Channel 8.